1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium at 203 North Vine Street in Urbana. This Monday evening, November 21st, from 6 to 8 p.m., the Corkscrew will be hosting a holiday tasting of Red and White Premier Cru and Grand Cru wines from Burgundy. More information at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Our guest in this portion of the program is writer Natasha Tarpley. Her books for children have won many honors. Her themes include self-acceptance, the relationship between parent and child, and connecting with the experiences of elders. Her children's books are I Love My Hair, Bippity Bop Barbershop, JoJo's First Flight, and Destiny's Gift. Natasha Tarpley is also the author of a memoir, Girl in the Mirror, Three Generations of Black Women in Motion. It's a family memoir told in the voices of three generations. She's also the editor of Testimony, Young African Americans on Self-Discovery and Black Identity. Natasha Tarpley is in Champaign-Urbana to meet with families this evening at the Champaign Public Library. She's the library guest this year for the Selma K. Richardson Author Celebration. Now, the event with families, all the seats are taken. However, you're welcome to come out to the library at 8 o'clock this evening for a book signing. Everyone is invited. Listeners, I look forward to you joining our conversation this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming in, visiting with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. What led you to a desire to write books for children?
Well, I've always written, so I never envisioned it as a particular genre or type of book that I would write. But I started writing when I was 7, and I was lucky enough to grow up in a household with lots of books and with parents who really encouraged reading and creative expression in all forms. And I had a mom who wrote, so she had a big old electric typewriter that she would lug out, and I was just fascinated by this process. It was a really special time for her. She'd go off into our breakfast nook and just, you know, disappear for a while in terms of just be really focused on what she was writing. And so that inspired me to try it myself. And I found out that there was something very magical about that process, the use of the imagination, the creation of all kinds of different worlds. And as a shy little girl, that was a very powerful gift.
Yeah, as a shy kid, it's wonderful to be able to enter the world or many worlds through books. And it's a comfortable place. You can be in there all by yourself, but yet you can be out exploring at the
same
time.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Well, what do you remember about writing as a 7-year-old?
I remember it being a lot of fun, which, you know, sometimes when you start to do something that you love for a living, it can sometimes feel like a job. But that time, it was very enjoyable. It was something, you know, when I talk to kids, I always just tell them how much fun it was to sit down with a piece of paper and, as you said, kind of create these worlds and enter these different worlds. So it was the thing that I did a lot, just for enjoyment.
Yeah. What kind of stories did you write early on?
Early on, I think I was writing more poetry than stories. I would write songs for my mom or, you know, rhyming poetry mostly. And then as I got older, probably into late elementary and early middle school, I would write stories about being the kind of nerdy girl who gets the popular guy, or, you know, I had one story that sort of mixed fantasy with these themes of acceptance and popularity, where the main character finds a Coke can and then, you know, there's a genie inside of the Coke can. And of course, you know, he's a really great guy and all the girls like him, but, you know, so, I mean, just things like that, that were not only imaginary, but also kind of a way to think about my own identity and you know, again, going back to being shy and work through some of those things, you know, say things that maybe I wouldn't have said. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I am impressed in the three books that I have. I have not read Destiny's Gift, but the books that I have here with me in the studio, I am so impressed by the way you speak to children in these books. The books raise awareness, they aim to inspire, and I think also you look to children in how you talk to them, in that you actually ask them to go perhaps and do something, like with JoJo's first flight. You know, you suggest maybe doing some reading in history.
Mm-hmm.
And so you stir up some expectation on the part of the reader. Now, how do you do that without lecturing?
Oh, I don't know. I think part of it is my idea or intention that I have in the book is really to celebrate more than to lecture. One of the reasons I started writing children's books was because I was looking at, and particularly books that feature African-American characters, I was looking at what was there, and I just saw so much stuff that was so heavy and message-oriented, and I really wanted to write books that celebrated childhood, whether you were black, yellow, green, blue, whatever,
mm-hmm.
So that African-American kids could see themselves just as children, but then also have this celebration of their culture, and in a way that was very natural, not something that you should know this or you have to do this. And
right.
So that's kind of, I think, part of that. You know, fundamentally, it's about really celebrating who you are and that sense of creativity and freedom in childhood.
Yeah, you must have a really good memory of your own childhood and feel close to that and to the experiences of children as well.
I do, not so much of the particulars, but of the emotional aspects of that.
Yeah,
and I draw on that a lot.
Yeah. I Love My Hair, that was your first book.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was followed by Bippity Bop Barbershop.
Yes.
Two books, one essentially aimed, I guess, at little girls, and that's I Love My Hair, and Bippity Bop Barbershop aimed at little boys. And you know, reading these books, I was so reminded of what my mother would tell me when she would comb out the snarls in my hair. And, you know, it would be painful on the one hand, but it was a wonderful time that we shared. And to get us through this ouchy period, she'd say, you know, your hair is your crowning glory.
Hmm.
You know, was that the message the same from your mom?
Exactly. I mean, we had a whole elaborate ritual where she would comb my hair and she would actually pretend that there are people who lived in my hair. So every time we got to a tangle, we would make up a story about that particular character who lived in that section of my hair. So it was this kind of wonderful sharing, but also really inspiring and very, it was one of the things that I remember in terms of starting to think about stories and character and that kind of thing. So very early on,
yeah,
that was an influence there.
It's really wonderful, the dedication to your mom, Marlene, in the book. You say, to my mother, Marlene, for making my hair a house,
yeah,
where dreams live and grow.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Well, now tell us about Bippity Bop. You drew on your experiences as a girl going to the barbershop in Chicago in your neighborhood.
Yeah, I did all kinds of crazy stuff with my hair. So, and one of those things that I did was to shave it all off, and I would wear it very short, and I went to the barbershop to get it cut. And I really enjoyed that experience. As a woman, I was a little bit outside of it, but I was able to observe the sharing among men that I saw happening in the barbershop. And of course, now there are women who go to the barbershops as well, but I really kind of felt that sense of communion and community in the barbershop. And of course, there have been lots of books that have come out recently about the African-American barbershop experience and how that's kind of a place where people share information, they pass on traditions and culture. So it's a really important important place.
Yeah. And now we've had at least three movies.
Yeah, definitely.
As well, set in the barbershop.
For better or for worse.
Yeah. What inspired JoJo's Flight? Now, this is it's a flight of departure, if you will, from the two books, I Love My Hair and Bippity Bop Barbershop.
JoJo's First Flight actually started off as a poem, a long poem that I wrote about a fictional group of African-American men during the 1920s who really wanted to fly. And at that time, African-Americans weren't given the chance to go to flight school. They weren't allowed to get pilot's licenses or, you know, fly planes and that kind of thing. So I was really curious about that, not only in the sense of the actual experience of being able to fly, but the whole metaphor of flight and transcendence and that kind of thing, and how despite all of these obstacles that have been placed in our path historically, there were people who actually went beyond that, flew beyond that. There are people like Bessie Coleman, who was the first African-American woman to have a pilot's license in the United States. And she went to France to get her pilot's license. And even in very small ways, kind of refusing to accept limitations. And so JoJo's First Flight is grew out of that poem into a story about a little boy who really wants to fly and decides that that's exactly what he's going to do. And there's the story is told as sort of a dream sequence, so there's a question as to whether or not he really does it. But the whole idea is, you know, to kind of believe in your dream and to actually work to fulfill it.
Yeah. He takes flight. He's at the controls in a 1920s biplane.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I found out during my research, a kid of about 8 or 9 could actually fly one of those planes. So we'll see. I don't know.
Do you fly?
Do I fly as in...
Are you a pilot?
No, not at all. I fly in my imagination. I think that's about...
Yeah. Well, when you were a girl growing up, 7 years old, you were writing stories and poetry, songs. Did you want to be a writer? Did you dream of being a writer?
I can't say that I actually consciously thought about that. It was something that was a part of me almost. Writing was something that I did no matter what. And it became sort of this natural evolution of writing stories for my mom and poems for my mom, reading and finding out, hey, there are magazines out there that actually publish work, and then sending work to those magazines, and then finding out, hey, you can actually do a book. So it was a very natural progression. It was never something that was very directed in the sense of I'm going to be a writer, but I just knew that that was something that would always be a part of my life.
Mm. What's Destiny's Child about? Or is it
that's
Destiny's?
People always get that confused. It's Destiny's Gift.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. And it's about a little girl who, again, loves to write. I use a lot of autobiography. And she has a mentor who's the owner of an independent bookstore in her community. And as it turns out, it looks like this bookstore may close, as are many independent bookstores around the country. And that was one of the themes that I wanted to bring in, to really talk about the value of these institutions in our community. And so the little girl uses her gift of words to try to save the store. And I really wanted to kind of show kids that even though they may not be able to vote yet or may not be able to drive or any of these big adult things, that there are things that they can do that really make a difference and that are really important contributions to their community. So,
I imagine that one of the rewards of writing books for children is then being able to go to bookstores, to libraries, to schools, and to read them to the children and experience that thrill with them. What's it like out there in schools and libraries and bookstores when you meet with the kids, with librarians, with the people who work in the bookstores, with the parents of the children?
I mean, it's really great. It's like, you know, meeting with your people. You know, you have this kind of tribe of book lovers and people who kind of know where you're coming from. And so that's really wonderful. And what's even more rewarding for me is meeting kids who come up to me afterwards and say, you know, hey, I really like to write, or they have their notebooks with them and they show me their poems or their stories. And just to be able to play a role even in that short amount of time in encouraging them and making them know that, you know, it's okay to do this and really actually cool that you're doing it. That's to me is the most rewarding part.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is writer Natasha Tarpley. She is the author of a number of children's books, including Destiny's Gift, I Love My Hair, Bippity Bop Barbershop, and JoJo's First Flight. She's also the author of a memoir, Girl in the Mirror, Three Generations of Black Women in Motion. She's in Champaign-Urbana to meet with families this evening at the Champaign Public Library. She's the library's guest this year for the Selma K. Richardson Author Celebration. And the event is booked. All the seats are reserved. However, at 8 o'clock, everyone is welcome. Everyone is invited for a book signing. So if you'd like to meet our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine and have her sign a book, she'd be more than happy to do that. That's at 8 o'clock this evening at the Champaign Public Library. In the meantime, you can join us this afternoon with your questions or comments. The phone lines are open. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area. 333-9455 is the number to call. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our technical director is Jason Croft. And we've got a call coming in. And so as soon as we get this call set up, we will go and talk with a listener. I expect the caller in the Champaign-Urbana area. And I want to stall here. And so we get the listener hooked up here this afternoon so I don't launch into another topic and then have them wait on the telephone for us. So let's go and talk with a caller, a listener in Chicago on line one. Hi.
Yes, I'm a great fan of Ms. Tarpley.
A friend?
Yeah. I'm a great fan of hers, admirer of her work, and I really look forward to seeing her this evening in Champaign. I was kind of wondering what if she could talk about the experience of working with an illustrator, what that's like.
Well, thank you, Jess. this is Tahimba Jess, the poet who actually is in the Champaign-Urbana area now.
I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Working with an illustrator is actually not as an extensive a process as most people might think, and certainly I was surprised to know that I had very little input on what my book was going to look like. Once I surrendered my manuscript to the publisher generally takes that to their own art department and they make an assignment to an illustrator that they've worked with. I mean, it's a very thoughtful assignment in terms of the style of the illustrator and the way the words and the pictures would work together. But I had very little input on that end of it. Now, if something goes wrong, then of course you say, you know, this isn't exactly what I envisioned, but it's really not a lot of control.
Yeah. So did you talk at all with E.B. Lewis, who illustrated the first three, and then there was another illustrator, Ajoa Burroughs, for Destiny's Gift?
Not at all. I met E.B. after the books came out.
Wow.
After I Love My Hair came out, we met for the first time. Ajoa and I have communicated, but we haven't met, and that was only after the book came out as well. So it's a very separate kind of process. I'm not looking over their shoulder. I'm not saying, I think you should, you know, put that like this or use that color there. So very separate.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hi. I had a couple of questions. First of all, are some of your books going to be for sale tonight at the book signing, or should we try to go to the bookstore first?
I actually am not sure about that. You might want to call the library to make sure.
Okay.
And if, you know, the worst case scenario, if you do get it beforehand, you just, you know, we'll have it.
Okay.
Just to be safe.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask is, do you remember, I don't know how many years ago, there was a controversy about a book written by an African-American called Happy I'm Nappy, something like
right.
that?
It was Nappy Hair, I believe.
Yeah, Nappy Hair.
Yeah.
And I think there's also another one called Happy I'm Nappy. But anyway, I was prompted to call you because of the title of one of your books and to ask you what you thought about that controversy a few years ago and also whether you've gotten any. I have to admit, I haven't read your book, so I don't know if this is even appropriate, but whether you've had any feedback from African-American parents about books about African-American hair, you know, or just the whole, I'm African-American myself, and I have a daughter, and we've gone through all these stages about hair and hairstyling and braiding and perming and, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah.
And she's gone through the thing, you know, going to school and wanting ponytails like all the little blonde girls in her class. You know, the whole thing that lots of black girls have to grow up with. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts to share on that.
Now that you're saying it, I don't quite remember what the crux of the controversy was about of nappy hair. I think it was more about...
well, some African-American parents felt it was insulting.
Right.
I
think there was a white teacher who had introduced it to the classroom,
right,
and I think the whole controversy over whether or not the word nappy is insulting
right.
and some of the illustrations maybe.
Yeah.
I don't have a whole lot to say about it. I think that it's really a personal choice.
Okay.
I choose not to use the word myself, but, you know, it's a personal choice. I know people who don't associate that with a negative meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I think what I was trying to do is really create a book where African American kids just celebrated themselves, you know,
yeah.
all aspects and really incorporated the sense of creativity. I don't know if you heard earlier, we were talking about the origin of the story was my mom used to comb my hair and she would pretend like they're people. This story is a little bit simplified. It's really kind of celebrating just the different styles that she wears her hair in, but she makes always a connection to something else. Like there's lots of metaphors in here.
Okay.
You know, her braids are like rows of plants or flowers in a garden,
mm-hmm.
or she weaves a puffy bun on top of her head, like, you mm-hmm. know, spinning wheels and that kind of thing. So it's really about also creativity and, just celebration. So that's the tone that I was
going for. I'm definitely going to try to buy it, and I hope I get a chance to say hi tonight.
Great. I hope so, too.
Yeah,
okay.
There will be a bookseller at the event tonight, I'm told.
Oh, great. Okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. It seems to me that links between generations are very, very important to you. Do you remember when and how you became aware that the experiences of your elders were a wealth of stories and were, I hate to use this word, instructive?
Very early on, I don't know if I got the instructive part early on, but very early on, and I tell this to the kids, I would just sit around the grown-ups in my house. I talk to them about the way different people speak and the different sounds of their voices and the accents. And much of my family was from the South, my grandparents and my great aunts and uncles. And so I would just listen to them speak and really absorbed their way. They were very expressive people. Their stories always had these really interesting details. So very early on, that was something that helped connect me, I think, to language itself and just the beauty and the music of language. And then later on, I began to, especially when I got into college, I think, more than any earlier time, I began to really connect with what they had experienced. I was an African-American studies major, and so I could see kind of the history in what they had experienced.
Yeah. I want to talk about the family memoir, Girl in the Mirror. And at the end of the book, you talk about how, as a child, you had to sort of be stealthy about kind of listening in. You had to plant yourself quietly and listen. And I find that really interesting. So the stories were gleaned surreptitiously almost.
Yeah, I think part of that history was very painful for a lot of people, some of the experiences that they had. And I think with the older people in my family, there was this need to, one, sort of forget it. You know, a lot of them came from the South to the North and were really determined to start new lives and not look back. And then there was this need to, I think, protect us as the children. You know, I always regret the fact that my great-grandmother, who moved from Louisiana and New Orleans to Chicago, who spoke Creole, never passed that language on to my grandmother. But the reason for that was, you know, if you're going to be living somewhere else, you know, this is, and in fact, even when they were in New Orleans, they didn't pass it on to the kids. I think there was this forward-looking attitude of, well, we're not going to do that. That's going to hold you back if you speak this language. So we're going to, you know, we're going to teach you this language. And so I think a lot of cultures have that, you know, the sense of wanting their kids to have a better life. And one of the one of the ways that we do that is to let go some of those things of the past, you know, to speak English or to, you know, not dress in a certain way. And to, so you end up losing quite a bit.
Yeah. The memoir opens in 1942 in the Deep South, and it is a letter being written by a woman by the name of Anna. She's writing to her husband, and if I might, this is the crux of the letter, what is actually written on the page. All of us are doing fine. How was your ride? I hope I packed enough for you to eat. Everything here is the same as you left it. Don't worry about me. I'll be all right until we can be together again in Chicago. Everyone misses you, and we wish you well. You are in our prayers. Your loving wife, Anna. That's what's on the page to her husband, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
But between the lines, there's so much more in Anna's thoughts, in her heart. There's so much more. Would you read an excerpt from the opening of the memoir?
Sure. So the letter begins, "Dear Jack, so there it was. The emptiness he left behind had beat me back to the house and was already in the kitchen, leaning back in Jack's chair and grinning with its feet propped up on the table. Don't look as you pass. Just keep walking to the stove, eyes steeled on the coffee pot. Light the burner beneath the kettle. Reach for two cups hanging on the hook above the sink. Remember, take down one. There's a clean saucer in the dish drain. Doesn't match your cup. Use it anyway. Stand on tiptoe to reach the coffee tin in the cabinet over the stove. Jack was supposed to finish that footstool before he left. Maybe you can ask one of the brothers. Maybe Buddy or Herb will do it. 4 tablespoons of coffee for the percolator. Too much. 3 teaspoons of sugar in the cup. No, that's what Jack takes. Jack always did have a sweet tooth. Steady yourself against the stove. Get it together, girl. Get yourself together. Leave that cup and start over. 1 tablespoon coffee, 1 teaspoon sugar. That's your cup. Already the kettle is singing and you haven't even got the cream out the box. Usually you end and the kettle begins on the same note. You slip in, girl, get it together. Get yourself together. All of us here are doing fine. Somehow, when I turned around, I half expected the emptiness to be gone, chased away by the clatter of cups and saucers, the rattle of coffee grounds, the spoon clinking against the side of my cup as I stirred and kept stirring until I could get up the nerve to turn around. The emptiness was still there, and now that I was facing it, the only thing left to do was to go on over to the table and sit down. "Morning," said the emptiness. I didn't say anything. "Aw, come on, Anna, don't be that way. I didn't do nothing to you for you to be acting so mean. Can I at least have a smile this morning? Just one itty-bitty smile?" I kept my eyes on my coffee. "You know, sooner or later you're going to have to make peace with me." I sat upright and opened my mouth, but no sound came out. "What you going to say, gal? Wasn't nothing you could say to keep that man here, and ain't nothing you can say now that he gone. Face it, me and you gonna be like 2 peas in this little house. That's all there is to it." And sure enough, when I went to make the bed, the emptiness was there in the sheets, still wrinkled in the shape of his body. It was there pressed up against me as I cleaned the greens for supper, breathing down my neck and begging for a taste when I bent to check the ham browning in the oven. It was stretched back in the armchair as I dusted around the living room, rippling through the dirty water left over from the wash, swaying with the clothes, blowing like ghosts on the line.
That's from the opening of Girl in the Mirror, Natasha Tarpley's memoir, family memoir. Tell us a little bit about Anna and Jack, the man she's writing to.
Those are my grandparents on my mother's side. My grandfather was originally from Alabama. His family had a big dairy farm down there, and he was a man that I really identified with, although I never got to meet him. He died shortly after I was born. But just seeing his pictures, he was a very stern-looking man, and hearing stories about him, he was always striving to achieve this thing. And I don't know exactly what that thing was, but I sometimes feel that within myself. You know, you've got to get there, you've got to get there, you've got to get there. And I had this impression that he always was reaching for something. He started several businesses, so he always wanted to be independent. He wanted to create a life for his family. So he was a very focused and directed man, and sometimes I think a bit hard on himself from what I can gather. My grandmother was a very independent woman as well, and she was a very feisty woman, very directed, and I think I learn a lot from her. I would say that I'm a kind of a quieter person, but I learned a lot from her about kind of keeping something for yourself is what she would always tell me.
Mm. We see that in the reserved nature of the letter that she sends to Jack.
Yeah.
The words that she sends him are very businesslike almost.
Yeah.
But at home, she's dealing with, you know, the fact that he's gone.
Yeah.
And she's feeling lonely. And will they be together again?
Yes, definitely they will. And again, that's her independent nature. It's like, okay, this is the way you wanted to do it right now. But she actually ends up in the book towards the end deciding to go to Chicago on her own. And not allowing him to say when and, and you know, that kind of thing. So she was that kind of woman, too. Yeah.
In the next chapter, we hear Jack's voice, and his thoughts are also packed with emotion. And he's riding north out of Alabama to Chicago. And at once, he wants to leave Alabama, but he also feels a little bit of a tug back.
I think it was hard for him to leave. You know, he had a family there that was very much established, you know, very much attached to the land, to the sense of, you know, when you have a farm, you have a very strong family network and a sense of collaborative working together. And I think it was hard for him to leave that. But at the same time, that thing in him that made him want to do his own thing, that made him want to find this thing that he was looking for, was a stronger pull. So, and I think that's indicative of a lot of our experiences when we leave home. You know, you have this connection to where you come from, but then, you know, there's this sense of searching and moving beyond that. And the other thing I'd like to say about this memoir is that it is an experimental memoir. So it uses quite a bit of fictional technique. It's told, and the first section is told in the voices of my grandmother, my grandfather, maybe one or two other characters, like my great aunt and a family friend. And they're small vignettes. The second section is told in the first person also from my mother's perspective. And then at the end, it returns to the small vignettes in my voice. But really, one of the things I was trying to get at was going back to your question about lessons and stories. There's a lot that doesn't get said, you know, that we did not learn from the past. Mm-hmm. And I think the structure of this book, in terms of the little snapshots, kind of leaves space for what is not said, but also tries to create a way to maybe envision, you know, what might have been said, you know, this kind of reading between the lines kind of thing.
Yeah. I really like it. I really like imagining family and their experience and imagining when they were strong and when they weren't so strong.
Yeah.
You know, it's that mix of strength and vulnerability. And when you grow up, hopefully you really appreciate,
yeah,
you know, the folks that came before you and what they went through. And you can then, you know, as you said earlier, I don't know how well I appreciated the lessons of my elders when I was young, but you get to a point where you begin to understand. And at the end, there's a wonderful appreciation of your mother, you know, what she told and what she held back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think my mom actually was sort of the most forthcoming, but there were things that I kind of sensed about her, and that I kind of learned through my own experiences. I mean, that's the other thing about this book. It's about three generations of women looking at my grandmother, my mother, and myself, and just seeing the echoes and the similarities and some of the choices that we made in relationships and deciding to leave home and those kinds of things. So I really was a way of getting to know myself, too, in writing about these three women, because I found so many, many similarities and so many, going back to this idea of lessons that they had learned, but that I had to kind of learn myself through experiences.
Yeah. What does your mom think of the book?
She was very supportive. I mean, she reads everything that I write, so she's kind of my first reader, my first critic, and was very open about telling her story and very open about... one of the things I did not want to do in this book was to just write a huge tome about, you know, my family history and tell everything. I mean, but the things that are in there are things that she was very willing to share. So,
yeah, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Natasha Tarpley. Listeners, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, we've got about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. Your questions and comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. What are you working on at the moment?
I just got back from Zurich, Switzerland. I was there for 2 months at the James Joyce Foundation there. I was sitting with Mr. Joyce, studying his work. Some of the things that he does, I think, are going to be very helpful to me. I'm a long ways down the road thinking about an adult novel. Right now, I'm also working on a series of middle grade novels.
Yeah. When you get together with children at events in schools, libraries, bookstores, What kinds of things do you talk about with the kids?
I talk a lot about my experiences. We read the story, and especially with a book like I Love My Hair, because the text is so spare, there's a lot of things that I can pull out of it. There's a lot of metaphors, so we practice making metaphors and similes, and we talk about, you know, their experiences with getting their hair combed and how you can write a book about your experience that can apply to a lot of people, and how people's experiences are pretty much the same, you know, so that what you have to say is important and that will probably resonate with, you know, someone else. They've probably gone through the same thing that you have.
Yeah. And right from the outset, I believe in I Love My Hair and Bippity Bop Barbershop, there are notes from you to the reader. So that is you're sharing your experience on the page, and then we're into the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do you have any advice for us when it comes to, with children, fostering a love of reading and writing?
I think it goes back to what many people are always saying, that it really comes from the parent and from the people around the child, to really kind of to make that a fun experience. You know, I used to, going to the library was my favorite thing. You know, I would rather go to the library than go to, you know, the beach or whatever amusement park. I mean, it was a fun thing. And, you know, everyone is not going to receive it in the same way, but I think to have the best shot at it, it has to be something that's interactive with the parent and the child, reading stories, you know, asking the child to tell stories. And I think children are natural storytellers, and to be able to encourage that, even in combing hair or, you know, making dinner or something like that, you know, is, you know, I think important.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about what makes a good story?
Oh, God, I don't know. I think a story that touches you is a good story. I mean, there are lots of technical things that we can go on about, but I think a story that touches you, that, you know, you learn something from, is a good story.
Yeah, and we're all storytellers.
Yeah, definitely.
And a good story might be a whole different thing than a good book, but
right,
we're all storytellers. There was a guest this morning on the Morning Talk program, a psychoanalyst, who said what we do in the world is we tell stories, and that's how mm-hmm. we make sense of
exactly.
the world, and that's how we get through the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of stories out there to tell. When you tell a story to a child, or when you read it, are there things that you do with your voice, with your body, to pull them in?
Sometimes. I have to say I'm not a very performative reader. I think the things that I do mostly to engage kids is having an interactive experience with them. So, you know, I don't really make all the bells and whistle sounds, but, you know, just to involve them in the process of reading the story and talking about the story.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. You're doing a lot of talking with your
hands.
Definitely. I wish people could see you this afternoon here on the program. Behind the microphone, she's very, very expressive with her hands, our guest this afternoon. We're out of time. Anything you want to leave us with?
If you're writing, keep writing, you know, and just, you know, there are lots of ways to write and publish, you know, so I just hope that it's something that you continue to do and to read and to share that with children.
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha Tarpley has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of The Afternoon Magazine. This evening, she will be at the Champaign Public Library for a book signing at 8 o'clock this evening. That follows the Selma K. Richardson Author Celebration for this year. Natasha is the library's guest this year for that celebration. There will be a bookseller at tonight's event, so if you'd like to buy some books and have Natasha sign them for holiday giving or for giving to your children or for reading yourself, you're more than welcome. this afternoon, or this evening, at 8 o'clock at the Champaign Public Library. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade on this Monday afternoon, futures in the bean pit finished the day just a bit higher up, about 2 to 3 cents for the day, but not before they traded a bit lower on the day following last week's pretty dismal moves in the marketplace, at least to the lower side, if you're into the bean market on that side. And they did manage just a bit of a bounce today. We'll try to find out from Kurt Kimmel this afternoon whether he thinks they can continue to move higher over the coming week as we go through Thanksgiving week. Very shortened week, by the way. No trade on Thursday, and I believe a half-a-day trade on Friday of this week. Dave Dickey and I have decided that we're going to take that day off and spend it with our family, so you'll need to get some updates if you want them from your DTN, because we're going to take the day off and spend it with our family. So no markets here on Friday of this week, that despite the fact that the board will be open for about a half a day of trade. Now let's take a look at what happened. The numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade in Chicago with the wheat pit. December futures in the wheat pit down 3.5 cents today. They traded below $3. In fact, they finished below $3 today, 298.5, the final price for December contract. The high at 303.5, the low at 298. Settlement price 298.5. They were off 3.5. The March futures 319.5, the high, the low at 313, and a settlement price of $3.13 and a quarter. They were off 4.5 cents. May futures 327.5, the high, the low at 322.5, settled at $3.22 and three quarters. They were down 4.25 for the day. And July futures 335.5, the high, the low at 330, settlement price at 331.25. They were off 3.75. September futures down 3 cents, 340 the settlement price, the high at 43, the low at $3.40. That for the SEP wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade. Now the corn pit, December contract up a quarter, 192.25, the final price. The low, or the high price, the low at 191.25, the settlement price at 191.5, and they finished a quarter higher in the December wheat contract. March futures 206, the high, the low at 204.75. Settlement price there, 205.25, unchanged. May futures up a quarter, 213.5, the final day. Final price for this day, 214, the high, the low at 13.25. May settlement price for the corn at 213.5. Once again, it was up a quarter for the day. July futures, 222, the high, low at $2.21, settled 221.25. They were unchanged. September's 230.5 high, low at 230. Settlement price a quarter above the low at 230.25. They were up a half for the day. For the SEPs, December futures 241.25, the high, the low at 240.5. December futures 2006 in the corn pit, settled at 241. They were up a quarter on the day. December oats now 171, the high, low at $1.68.5. Settlement price 170.5, up 2.5 cents. And the March up 3, 178.75 settlement price for the March oats. January soy complex beans now 576, the high, the low at 570. Settlement price for the January beans, 572.25. They were up 2.5 cents. March futures a 582.5 high, low at 577. Settlement price at 579.75, up 2.5. And the May soybeans, 587.75, the high, the low at $5.82. Settled 585.25. They were up 2.5 on the day. July futures in the bean pit up 3, 593.5 the high, the low at 88, settlement price at $5.91.25. Once again, that July contract up 3 for the day. The August soybeans, 596.5 the high, the low at 591.5. August 2006 beans settled at 593.5, up 3.75. September futures, 595.5 the high, the low at 591. Not quite out to the new crop soybeans, but 592.75, the settlement price for the September beans up 3. And next year's November contract, $6 the high, the low at 594, settlement price at 598.25. And they finished the day 3.25 higher. Bean meal futures, the rest of the complex now. Bean meal 173.90 in the December contract, a settlement price there up $1.70. Had a high today of 175.20 and a low at 172.30. Once again, the final price at 173.90, up 170 for the December bean meal. January bean meal 175.60, the high, the low at 173.30. Settlement price $174.90 a ton, up 170. December bean oil 22.20, the high, the low at 21.90, settled 21.93. They were down 8 for the day. And January bean oil 22.13, the final price, down 6 with a high of 22.40 and a low at 22.09 for the day. Now here with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. A lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange. January feeder cattle, the high 113.60, the low 112.65, the settlement 112.67.5. That down 92.5. March 111.65, the high 111 even, the low, the settlement 111.07.5. That down 67.5. April feeder cattle 110.15, the high 109.70, the low, the settlement 109.92.5. That down 42.5. December live cattle 90.85, the high 89.95, the low 90.32.5, the settlement, that down 70. February live cattle 93.50, the high 92.57.5, the low, the settlement 92.75, down $1. December lean hog 62.12.5, the high 60.62.5, the low, the settlement 60.65, down 197.5. February 66.30, the high 64.60, the low 64.62.5, the settlement, that down 192.5. April 67.50, the high 66.35, the low, the settlement 66.57.5, that down 125. May lean hog 69.05, the high 68.22.5, the low, the settlement 68.40, that down 105. February pork bellies 88.62.5, the high 86.70, the low, the settlement 86.75, that down 177.5. The Dow is down 26 points at 10,793. The NASDAQ, excuse me, that's up 26 points. The Dow up 26 points. The NASDAQ up 5 at 2232. The S&P 500 3 higher at 1251.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Sometimes Retha Hankins conceals her hunger from her husband.
I'd lie to him. If I wasn't eating at dinner, I'd tell him I ate. So I would make sure he would get what he needed and kids would get what they would need and I just go without.
How the Working Poor Survive, our series on food insecurity in America, begins with a visit to rural Virginia today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 Central on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock Central Time, 49 degrees in Urbana. A lake effect snow advisory has been posted for LaPorte and St. Joseph counties in northern Indiana, effective from 1 o'clock Tuesday morning, tomorrow morning, to 1 o'clock Wednesday morning, Eastern Time. Ed Kieser's forecast for the two states this afternoon in Illinois and Indiana, a mix of clouds and sunshine, highs ranging from 43 in northeastern Indiana to 55 in southwestern Illinois. Tonight,